DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Nick Martin in Germany. On today's programme, border incursion. Is Ukraine playing with fire by advancing into Russian territory?
It's shown that Ukraine still has some fuel in the tank that it can still take its opponent by surprise.
Kamala Harris leads Donald Trump in the latest US election polling, but are American voters in Europe energised by her campaign? As the huge iron gates creak open, why is Britain releasing thousands of prisoners early?
Staff being attacked by prisoners. We had one incident where 11 staff ended up in accident and emergency.
And why visitors to Italy's many private beaches this summer may find them shut. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. After a failed counteroffensive last year, Ukraine's incursion into Russia's western Kursk region, which began 2 weeks ago, has certainly turned the tide in the 2.5-year conflict. But for how long? The risky manoeuvre has helped Kyiv's forces to gain control of 1,250 square kilometres of Russian territory. Ukraine says it wants to force the Kremlin into agreeing a fair peace. It's certainly been a morale boost, but Moscow is now sending thousands of troops to the region to fend off the advance. I asked DW's Kyiv correspondent Nick Connolly, who's currently in the border town of Sumy, how much of a gamble this incursion is for Ukraine.
I think most people in Ukraine are convinced that all the talk of red lines, of Vladimir Putin's red lines, if Ukraine does X, then Russia will do Y. They are, for the most part, convinced that Vladimir Putin has already thrown everything he has at them. They'll tell you the Russians bombed a children's hospital in Kyiv, Okhmadyt, earlier in the summer, even before Ukraine went into Kursk region. Short of nuclear weapons, what have they got left? And as for the nuclear weapons, well, most people are convinced that the Chinese leadership has made it clear that using nuclear weapons isn't an option that they would accept. The US also, we believe, has given warnings to the Russians about that. So the thing you'll hear most often from them is, why should we be fighting a much bigger, stronger opponent with our arms tied behind our back? He's thrown everything he has at us. He's given us his worst. So what more can happen?
Now, Nick, this is a massive turnaround for Ukraine after, as you mentioned, the failed counteroffensive last year. It must be being seen by ordinary Ukrainians as a huge morale boost. What are they telling you?
I think the pictures coming out of Kursk have been a huge morale boost. I think it's really changed the dynamic, the kind of narrative around where this war is going. It's shown that Ukraine still has some fuel in the tank, that it can still take its opponent by surprise. And if the briefings and the kind of off-the-record conversations we've had are to be believed, then so far this seems to have been at relatively little cost in terms of lives and technology lost, certainly in comparison to last year's counteroffensive along Russia's armoured and mined front lines in the south of the country. And I think there's a real sense that this is about showing the outside world that Ukraine is still worth supporting and that it's not time yet to force Ukraine into some kind of negotiations on Russian terms.
And we're hearing conflicting reasons why Kyiv made this move, including forcing Moscow into what they say is fair negotiations. What exactly does Ukraine hope to achieve from this incursion?
Most immediately, it's about forcing Russia to draw down its forces in occupied Ukraine, especially in the Donetsk region, where Russian forces have been making advances, and to force them to send those troops to Kursk to defend there. It's also about embarrassing Vladimir Putin domestically, to show Russians that he's not able to defend Russia's borders and keep them safe. It's also about showing the wider world that Ukraine, on the one hand, is able to basically take everyone by surprise, take Russia by surprise, but also change the narrative, that it can still advance at speed, that this isn't all just a war of kind of bogged down front lines. And I think the hope is also by showing Russians through Ukrainian social media that Russian prisoners of war have been treated as per the rules fairly, and also civilians, that ordinary Russians don't have anything to fear from Ukraine on Russian territory, that Ukraine's beef, as it were, Ukraine's problem is not with the Russian people, but with the occupation of Ukraine and with Vladimir Putin. That seems to be the line that they're pushing.
And we've seen the images of at least three key bridges blown up in the Kursk region. How much damage have Ukraine's forces done so far to Russia's ability to fight this war?
So the three bridges we've seen destroyed on social media, and there's also some pontoon bridges that the Russians try to put up in replacement of those bridges that also seem to be getting attacked. They are further west of the main area that Ukraine controls in Kursk region, an area where a considerable number of Russian troops are now seemingly, if the reports we're getting are accurate, basically encircled because they can't cross out of the region by bridge. And on land further east, the Ukrainian troops seem to have closed the little gap they could have got through up till a few days ago. And so this is about obviously cutting them off from logistics, stopping them fighting, but also the aim seems to be on the Ukrainian side to take as many Russian soldiers prisoner as possible to then exchange them for Ukrainians in Russian captivity, some of whom have been in Russian captivity now for 2 years or more. We've been hearing reports, again, nothing we can verify, that Ukraine in the past 2 weeks basically has been able to take as many Russian soldiers prisoner as in the previous 2.5 years or so of war. So that is definitely massive and will make a huge difference. And also it's not just soldiers, it's conscripts, people doing their military service at age 18, 19, 20. And we're already seeing a very different reaction from Russian society to these people ending up in captivity to when professionals or people, you know, later in life who'd signed up for big salaries are taken prisoner. That didn't really provoke the same reaction from their families or from wider Russian society. So that's really something the Ukrainian side hopes will cause internal problems for Vladimir Putin's government.
And Russia is now pulling troops into Kursk for what could be a major escalation. What do we know or can we guess about Russia's planned response?
I don't think we have a very clear image yet of what they plan to do. There have been reports that Vladimir Putin has told his military that they need to get the Ukrainians out by the 1st of October. We're not sure how accurate those reports are. There's certainly a lot of Russian planes being sent there to send in glide bombs and other weapons. Those are obviously easier and faster to move over than to get troops who potentially were stationed in eastern Ukraine or elsewhere to collect all their stuff and move hundreds of kilometers. So that's going to take longer before we see boots on the ground moving. There is an expectation that the Russians will just use their supremacy in the air to bomb as many of the Ukrainian positions as they can and potentially, you know, take also risks with the lives of their own civilians who are still left. Really important to say, there are lots of Russian citizens there who didn't manage to get out, who were not evacuated and are waiting for humanitarian corridors. There's been talk from the Ukrainian side that some corridors will be opened for them to get through the front lines, but so far none of the details are clear.
I was talking there to DW's Kyiv correspondent, Nick Connolly. The two parties in the United States have now held their conventions and the clock is ticking down to Election Day in November. Both Republican candidate Donald Trump and Democratic rival Kamala Harris are neck and neck, with Harris leading in some polls. From Brussels, Terry Schultz reports that the enthusiasm Harris has sparked in the US has spread to Europe.
Vice President Kamala Harris has electrified the Democratic Party in a way that would have been hard to envision before President Joe Biden stood aside.
The delegates at the Democratic National Convention, well, they just completed their roll call. And they have nominated Coach Walz and me to be the next Vice President and President of the United States of America.
But the race will be tight, and that's why Democrats are paying new attention to a huge and largely untapped source of votes, Americans living overseas. There are almost 3 million eligible voters outside the U.S., more than enough to make or break a huge number of races, explains Amy Porter with Democrats Abroad France.
The margin of victory for Biden in Georgia and Arizona was smaller than the number of international votes. So, yeah, that's important.
Just after Harris took over the ticket, Democrats Abroad saw registrations to vote jump fivefold and applications to join the organization tripled. But historically, less than 8% of overseas voters actually cast ballots. Texas native Dana Freeling founded Democrats Abroad Finland after Trump took office in 2016 and, like many other volunteers, has been working nonstop for months.
It's really all hands on deck now, and we have all over the world people having phone banking campaigns on the ground, tabling registration events. We host many webinars where we have candidates, because it's not just about Vice President Harris and the top of the ticket. It's about the Senate, the Congress, and all the way down the ballot.
Both Amy Porter and Dana Freeling say they've been approached like never before by local residents wanting to help get Kamala Harris elected. Porter notes foreigners cannot donate money to U.S. campaigns, but they can give time.
Only once in a blue moon do we get local people, French people, non-U.S. citizens, reaching out to us and saying, I would like to help, because they understand the cataclysm that it would be if Trump got reelected for them as French people living in France.
As President, Donald Trump had a very fractious relationship with most of Europe and with NATO, while he had a more friendly relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin than many Europeans are comfortable with. Dana Freeling says that makes Finns a bit nervous, and they're also volunteering to help on the Harris campaign.
Finnish people ask. They know how much is at stake for the citizens of Finland, whether Trump or our Vice President Harris will take the helm next term. Our security here is depending on it.
But Mike Kulbikas, a Republican voter who's lived in Brussels for decades and has taken part in bipartisan debates on U.S. politics and policies, says this talk of a surge is just wishful thinking on Democrats' parts.
I think that most Republicans think it's going to be at least as easy as it was, maybe easier. Of course, the fact that she's a woman and that she's a minority, it will have some kind of an energizing effect on some voters. But overall, I think Republicans are as energized as they were before, if not more.
While Republicans Overseas is not officially an arm of the GOP, unlike Democrats Abroad's affiliation with its party, Kulbikas says its members are more reliable voters than Democrats. It's clear the Democratic Party is beginning to better appreciate the potential. Earlier this month, the Democratic National Committee decided for the first time in a presidential election to invest money to help Democrats Abroad get out the vote, $300,000. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Now to the UK, where the new Labour government of Keir Starmer has inherited a major crisis in prisons. Male prisons in England are more than 99% full, so London has triggered emergency measures to make more space. It could lead to delays in the court system because it means people will only be given a hearing when a prison place becomes available. The government had already announced plans to release thousands of inmates early over the next few months. But the head of the biggest union for prison officers is warning that the pressure for space is leading to violence. Our UK correspondent Lucy Taylor reports.
Prisons have never been peaceful. But behind these heavy gates, right now, the wings are noisier and busier than ever. Even the government says it's close to a crisis. Of almost 90,000 prison places, less than 400 are still available.
So our research in prisons are feeling all the pressure.
Mark Fairhurst leads the Prison Officers Association, the biggest trade union for frontline prison workers.
And most people in a reception prison are sharing a cell with a stranger because most cells are only designed for one inhabitant and now they're housing two. So it's really, really cramped. Prisoners are lucky to get out of the cell for an hour a day for even the most basic things like we go on the exercise yard or we'll give you a shower or you can phone your family at home because we simply haven't got the staff on duty to do that.
He says morale among prison officers is low and the pressure for space is putting them at risk.
Over the past 7 days, we've had some absolutely horrific incidents where we've come close to a murder, staff being attacked by prisoners. We had one incident where 11 staff ended up in accident and emergency. One with a dislocated shoulder. One had to have a brain scan because we thought he had a bleed on the brain. So it really is a hostile environment. And the risk we face, we don't get paid enough for it. We're not prepared enough for it. It's absolutely horrific and something needs to change.
Things have come to a head in prisons after racist riots broke out on streets across the country last month, meaning suddenly hundreds more people arrested and coming through the courts. But before that, prison numbers had already been rising for years, with courts handing down longer sentences. And many of those with experience of the system say the problem is not just the pressure for beds, but the pressure on resources, meaning prisoners are left without support.
You know, things like suicide, self-harm, drug use are way worse.
Sobhanan Narantharan runs Breakthrough, a social enterprise that works with people who've been in prison. He has his own lived experience, having spent a year in prison himself.
And yeah, that's all compounded to a point where when people are coming out of their cells, the atmosphere feels way more aggravated, if that makes sense, because people have just been sort of like locked up and holed away.
He says it doesn't always make sense to send people to prison in the first place.
The way I describe prison, it's the university of crime. You go to prison as oftentimes people on shorter sentences or even like medium length sentences will go there as petty criminals or non-violent offenders. Through their experience of prison, who they meet, who they interact with, and the culture of the environment, they'll often become worse criminals. Where you get non-violent offenders or people who are in that constant cycle of crisis and crime. So, you know, they're addicted to Class A drugs, mental health issues, they've shoplifted or they've committed some sort of offence which could have been dealt with in the community. You're putting them in prison. It's almost like it becomes this cycle of they get released, get back into the same thing and they're back in and out.
The new Labour government has made emergency plans to release thousands of prisoners early over the next few months. But while that may sound like good news for inmates, those who work with them say it could lead to higher rates of reoffending if the system doesn't invest in preparing them for life outside prison. The charity Landworks works with ex-prisoners when they're first released. It's a place in the countryside to come for training, counselling and community. They even sit down for lunch together every day.
Steve, do you want tomatoes?
Chris Parsons is the founder.
So most people, I don't think, want to get back into offending. If you put so many hurdles in front of them, so if you come out of prison, you've got no accommodation, very little money, nowhere, no one to look out for you at all, what are you going to do? You're cold, wet, you're probably going to start shoplifting again. You're probably going to get back on into drugs. And it's not a quick fix. It can't be quick fix at all. It takes time, a lot of time, and a desire to work with people who aren't necessarily in a... They're not presenting as the easiest people to work with.
But for now, the government is in firefighting mode. It says the emergency measures are temporary and a legacy of the previous Conservative government. That government committed £4 billion to building new prisons, which will open up thousands of new prison beds. But campaigners fear that without more investment tackling the root causes of crime, it might not be long until those are full too. Lucy Taylor, DW, in the UK.
Still to come, Italy's many family-run private beaches go on strike over reforms to ownership rules. DW's website and social media pages have the very latest news from across Europe, so that's dw.com or DW Europe on socials. And I'm Nick Martin in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. It's been a hot summer on Italian beaches, not just because of the prolonged heat wave. Tensions over who gets to run private beaches have flared. Managers of the thousands of family-run beachside concession stands and restaurants are protesting what they call government failure to resolve their status after an Italian court said the businesses must be put up for public tender. Megan Williams tells us more from the Tuscan holiday town of Viareggio.
A day at the beach in Italy is nothing if not full of costly options.
Allora, abbiamo tre diverse tipologie di ombrelloni.
Near the beachfront bar at the Lelio concession in the Tuscan holiday town of Viareggio, the manager lists them all off. A waterfront umbrella and lounge chair, €40 a day. Those in rows further back, €35. In higher-end beach concessions, prices for a lounge and some shade from the sun can run as high as €300 a day, with options for private change cabins, rooms, and pools. For well over a century, Italians have been mostly pleased to pay for the comfort offered by the private beach concessions, but which in recent decades have all but taken over the country's waterfront. Manager Marzia degli Innocenti jokes with longtime clients near the restaurant at the Pavia concession. She runs with her husband just down the beach.
Dal 1920.
She tells me the business has been in the family since 1920, when her husband's grandfather opened it. But, she says, it's now at risk. The EU ruled 2 decades ago that passing the beach concession licenses down the generation line is illegal, a decision that was backed by an Italian High Court ruling in April. The court ordered Italy to put the concessions up for public tender. The end of the year deadline for the government to do so is looming. With other entrepreneurs keen to make bids on the beachfront, they say they've been unfairly locked out of. But those who have the family licenses are resisting. In early August, Marzia was among the almost 30,000 private beach managers who closed their umbrellas for a few hours in the morning to put pressure on the government to allow them to keep their businesses, which they say they've invested hundreds of thousands of euros in, which they say they'd lose if they had to give up the licenses.
E poi per darla a chi è? Per darla a uno diverso che...
This is an Italian tradition, Marzia says. If you hold a tender, someone different could take over, a Chinese or American, and that's not right. It's a position Italy's right-wing Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni backs, despite being pro-free market. Among her election promises was one to the beach concession holders that they could keep their licenses.
Loro dicono che pagano molto, ma secondo me pagano poco.
But clients here, like the sunbather who pays about 3,000 euros a summer for an umbrella and lounge chair a few rows back from the water, says the fees to lease the beachfront the concession managers pay are peanuts, less than 1% of the revenue the businesses bring in. He says the managers are less concerned about tradition and more about profits.
Secondo me dovrebbe essere lo Stato a impuntarsi, punto e basta, perché sono...
The government needs to impose the tender, but it doesn't because it wants the votes of the sector, he says. Opening up competition is just one issue. The other issue, more space for public beaches, which have been reduced to overcrowded slivers of sand along privatized waterfront. A long, scorching sand path studded with cigarette butts and stones leads to the one public beach south of the Viareggio Tourist Center, past the port and industrial outskirts. It's as crowded as a carnival, with vendors, hawkers, and families with their own umbrellas picnicking under their little circles of shade. A stark contrast to the rows of rented, but mostly empty, lounge chairs on the private beaches. Unfortunately, you have to go outside the towns not to have to pay for the beach, says this woman. Despite the extra effort to get here, she says she now refuses to go to private beaches. For me, they're a powerful lobby I don't want to support. Despite the opposition to the family-run concessions, the government is unlikely to make waves with those who now hold the licenses, with a leaked document showing the government may extend the deadline by another few years. Megan Williams, DW, Viareggio.
And we'll be back in Italy in the next half hour. Sicily, in fact. Remember to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts to hear all the interesting stories from across Europe. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany.
Hot dust in the sky on a winter's day. Plastic bottles in the sea 1,000 miles away. Acid rain from the clouds turn the trees to grey. Playing Russian roulette with our future. Vapor trails smoke the sky like a cigarette. Politicians ride the skies in a private jet. Seems they haven't realized the situation yet. Self-destruction is the etiquette.
The
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany. In the next half hour, what did Dutch spy chiefs know about Ukraine's involvement in the attack on the Nord Stream gas pipelines? Lukashenko's critics face snooping from Belarusian authorities while reporting on the country from exile.
First, this is of course a signal. The regime wants to scare me. The regime wants to show me that they know what I do. Second, the regime wants to cut the connections between experts, journalists in exile and people inside the country.
Turkey cuts a deal to help Chinese automakers avoid EU tariffs on electric cars. How a nearly two-year-long drought is turning parts of Sicily into a desert.
If it rains, the water disappears straight into the sea, and there are no reservoirs and dams to contain the water. That's the big problem here. The very little water that is available just flows away.
And as Paris counts down to the Paralympic Games, how accessible is the French capital?
From the studios of Germany's international broadcaster, DW, this is Inside Europe.
The Dutch government is feeling the heat over revelations that senior officials likely knew about Ukraine's alleged involvement in blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines before they happened. Details about the sabotage in September 2022 of the pipes carrying Russian gas to Europe were shared by the Dutch Secret Service with the United States. As Stefan Bos reports, the revelations have also raised questions about former Prime Minister Mark Rutte, who is due to become the chief of the NATO military alliance in October.
U.S. sources say several Dutch government members likely knew about Ukrainian plans to attack the Nord Stream pipelines. They say that the Dutch Military Intelligence and Security Service, or MIVD, informed the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency about the sabotage plan shortly before the explosion of the Nord Stream pipelines in the Baltic Sea. It has led to political pressure on the recently elected government of former intelligence chief Dick Schoof. The largest party supporting the cabinet, the Anti-Islam Party for Freedom, the PVV, and others, demanded to know who knew about the sabotage plans. Mark Rutte, who was prime minister at the time and will soon be NATO's secretary general, previously shrugged off suggestions of possible US and Ukrainian involvement in the explosion during a turbulent parliamentary debate.
Ja, dat het echt onzin is, dus. Dat weet u zelf toch ook wel. Ik ga er nou niet allemaal op in, we moeten ook weer naar bed.
Yeah, this is nonsense, Rutte told legislator Thierry Baudet. But you know that yourself. I don't want to address that issue. It's time to go to bed.
Attributie naar Amerika.
However, well-informed sources say several ministers, including the then prime minister, must have known about the MIVD findings about Nord Stream. Outspoken PVV party leader Geert Wilders now insists on reconsidering the Dutch relationship with Ukraine, which is likely creating tensions within the coalition government. The Netherlands was among the first countries to send F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. While the debate continues in the Netherlands, German state prosecutors have issued an arrest warrant for a Ukrainian diving instructor who was allegedly involved in the attack. He is accused of being part of a team of experienced Ukrainian divers who hired a German yacht in September 2022. Investigators say they sailed out into the Baltic Sea and planted the explosives, blowing up three of the four Nord Stream pipelines. Informed and pressured by Washington, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky reportedly ordered an end to the operation, but by that time, it was too late. Russia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations, Dmitry Polyansky, has his doubts.
We had a very vivid discussion in the consultation room of the Security Council, and it looks like those who drafted them were initially making up a scenario of a Hollywood blockbuster. Actually, only one thing is clear. Germany has important information about this terrorist act, which it shares with journalists, but conceals from the Security Council.
In the Netherlands, critics such as the Eurosceptic Forum for Democracy Party share his concerns. They view the war between Russia and Ukraine as a broader battle between the US-led NATO military alliance and Moscow. Stefan Bos, DW, The Netherlands.
And after Ukraine's recent incursion into Russia's Kursk region, Kremlin ally Belarus says it's now worried that Kyiv's forces could attempt a similar move into Belarusian territory. Over the past week, Minsk says it has deployed nearly a third of its armed forces to the border with Ukraine. Meanwhile, Belarusian strongman Alexander Lukashenko is still arresting members of an opposition movement that disputes his 2020 presidential election win. The subsequent crackdown on public protests has been harsh, with more than 1,400 opposition activists in jail or forced to flee overseas. One of those who left is journalist Hanna Lyubakova, who told me that Lukashenko's repression is still in full swing.
For 4 years, our human rights defenders have been documenting daily violations in Belarus, which also means arrests. Between April and June this year, we have 450 arrests, and these are only 3 months, basically, we're talking about. So every day someone is being detained, being arrested in Belarus. People are being arrested for subscribing to independent media, for wearing white and red colors, which remind the regime of our national flag, which is being banned in Belarus. Most recently, a woman was arrested for an anti-war tattoo. So a tattoo was the reason for that. And regarding my case, on July 1st, I was sentenced to 10 years in absentia by a Minsk court. The regime accused me of 4 criminal charges, including an attempt to seize power. So these are the accusations I'm facing back in Belarus.
And Hanna, I just wonder how that sits with you, the prospect of a jail term if you ever return to Belarus. And how does that conviction hanging over you affect your ability to do your job as a journalist?
First, this is of course a signal. The regime wants to scare me. The regime wants to show me that they know what I do. They follow my work and I am being a target. Second, the regime wants to cut the connections between us, experts, journalists in exile, and people inside the country. It's much more difficult to talk to someone who is inside the country right now, especially after this public persecution, because people in Belarus might be scared, and rightly so, of talking to me. So these are kind of two main reasons here. So the first wants to divide us, or wants to prevent us from doing our job and communicating from people inside, getting to know what's happening there. And second, of course, they want to scare us and show that it's not safe for you. Even if you are abroad in a safe democratic country, we still follow you. We're still able to know what you do.
And do you get a sense that you're being monitored? And is this something that's happening on a day-to-day basis?
I wouldn't say that I feel this every day. I think that at some public mass gatherings of Belarusians, even if it's just a protest to commemorate something, political holiday or whatever, this is perhaps a way many of us feel that we might be monitored, and there were cases that the regime really was able to find out about some diaspora initiatives because they actually sent somebody there or they just found out in some other ways. So physical monitoring, right, this kind of surveillance that they might be able to still do by sending someone abroad to the EU or elsewhere. Second is, of course, digital monitoring. I had some cases when somebody pretended to be me. It was both on Telegram, it was also on Instagram. So we took down these accounts, but this is something that we can repeat. And when it comes to traveling, I am on the wanted list in Belarus, Russia, and OCS countries. So this is something that they do. They don't have to follow me. They just can put me on the wanted list. And if I travel to some of these OCS countries, I can be arrested. And this actually happened back in 2021 when I was arrested in one of the OCS countries. So after that, I found out that I'm on the wanted list. And of course, I have to take precautions regarding my travels.
And finally, Hanna, what is the sense you get from people inside Belarus right now? What has become of this fight to challenge Lukashenko's authoritarian rule?
Now it's really difficult to express any form of dissent. Any open protest, street protest is banned, of course. But even just a small gathering of people who might just come to a venue and enjoy art, this is something that can provoke the regime to disperse people, to arrest them. There were cases of music festivals when security forces came and just started arresting people. It wasn't even related to politics. It wasn't even anything about the opposition movement. So you see that any gathering, any mobilization, any way when people try to communicate, exchange opinions, talk, this is something that the regime thinks is dangerous for it. So at this point, of course, nothing like this is possible. Regarding people, you can feel the fear, you understand it, you know where it comes from, and of course it's very logical and natural that people feel fear. At the same time, they are trying to do whatever is possible. They learn their language, the Belarusian language, they learn about their culture, about their identity. And that's investment in the future. This is something that also helps us distinguish between Belarus and Russia. And this is more important than it sounds. Some might expect opposition protests, right? But they're not possible. Instead, people are investing their time in learning about our history, which, again, in the long term, is something that will help us build a national state in the future when the country is going to be free.
I was talking there to Belarusian journalist Hanna Lyubakova, who is currently reporting from exile. She's also a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank. Next, we head to southern Europe, where another summer of wildfires and severe droughts have reached crisis point. Sicily, for example, hasn't seen rain for more than 18 months. Some parts of the Italian island have waited more than 2 years for a good soaking. Farmers and residents are getting desperate, while the island has started turning tourists away. Angelo Van Schaik reports.
È caduto un altro?
It's 35 degrees, and when chicken breeder Giovanni Ciraz and I approaches Chicken Run, one of them falls off a small wall.
Cadono così, muoiono d'infarto.
It's probably had a heart attack. That's how they die in this heat. I'm losing 8 to 10 animals a day due to the drought and the heat. When I started this chicken farm 10 years ago, I had around 1,000 animals. Now I only have a handful left.
10 years ago, Giovanni Tirasa bought a piece of land in San Cataldo, a small town in central Sicily, to breed chickens. On his land, there was a small creek and a little pond. Now, 10 years later, the creek has become a dry trench, and in the pond the reeds are withering.
It hasn't rained as it should for 10 years. The rain has become less and less, and the last 2 years it hasn't rained at all. Not a single drop, nothing.
For his water supply, Ciraza depends on so-called autobotte, water trucks that deliver water to farmers and families. But it's expensive.
20 euros per cubic meter. If I get water from the local authorities, I'd have to pay 1 euro 20 per cubic meter. That's an increase of 1,000% or more. I can't afford that.
Besides being bone dry, it's also been exceptionally warm in Sicily this year. There was virtually no winter. In January, it was still 20 to 25 degrees. The situation in Sicily is tragic, says Christian Mulder. He's professor of ecology at the University of Catania.
The rivers have dried up, the few lakes as well, and there's no groundwater anymore.
A short drive from Ciraza's chicken farm to his colleague, goat herd Antonino Bonsignore, shows how serious the situation is. The remaining vegetation in this part of central Sicily is burned and brown yellowish. In a growing number of spots, the vegetation gives way to bare rock. Even the cactus are suffering. Nothing grows anymore, says Ciraza.
In the spring, farmers sowed their crops, but nothing came up. They weren't able to harvest anything this year.
The damage to Sicilian agriculture is an estimated 2.7 billion euros, and it will likely increase if the drought continues.
Vediamo se è sopravvissuto.
Antonino Bonsignore has been herding goats for most of his life. He's 80 years old and has never experienced a drought like this in his life.
For the last 3 years, it's hardly rained. Even tough weeds don't survive.
Despite his age, Bonsignore still takes his goats into the mountains every day. He used to have hundreds of goats, but because of the drought and the heat, he had to take many of them to the slaughterhouse.
Over the past few months, I've had to get rid of 35 goats. I couldn't afford them anymore. Food is expensive. The water truck comes by every 8 days, which is just about enough to survive. This has become a desert.
According to experts, by 2030, one-third of Sicily will have become desert. By 2050, two-thirds of the island will be lost to desertification, if nothing changes. Because besides of a changing climate, there's also a lack of political will to do something about the situation, says ecology professor Mulder.
If it rains, the water disappears straight into the sea, and there are no reservoirs and dams to contain the water. That's the big problem here. The very little water that is available just flows away. There's no systematic approach to prevent water shortages.
There is money to create reservoirs and dams to collect water and to repair the infrastructure. But it's not being spent on rectifying these problems. So almost half of Sicily's water is leaking from the pipes due to lack of maintenance. If nothing changes, Sicily will slowly turn into a desert and agriculture will be something of the past. Angelo van Schaik, DW, San Cataldo, Sicily.
And still to come, Turkey gives China a backdoor entry to the EU for its electric vehicles. We'd love to hear your feedback on any of the reports or interviews you hear. Drop a line to InsideEurope@dw.com and we'll get back in touch with you. This is Inside Europe and I'm Nick Martin in Germany. New tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles sparked a fierce response from Beijing, so much so that Brussels has scaled them back just 2 months after they were first imposed. China's car giant BYD plans to circumvent those remaining tariffs by building a billion-dollar factory in Turkey. Ankara, meanwhile, hopes such commitments will kick-start its struggling economy. The huge investment marks a big turnaround in relations between the two countries after years of tensions over Turkey's support of Chinese minority Uyghurs. But the car deal is a sign of growing common ground, not only economically, but diplomatically between the countries. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Efendim, ülkemize, milletimize, vatanımıza hayırlı uğurlu olsun inşallah.
祝合作成功，为土耳其带来福祉。
With much fanfare and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan present, China's BYD car giant signed an agreement to build a billion-dollar factory in Turkey. The factory will produce 150,000 cars annually, mainly for the European Union market. Sibel Karabel is a director of the Asia-Pacific Department of Istanbul's Gedik University. She says the deal marks a turning point in Turkish-Chinese relations.
The significance of this deal is that Turkey would be considered as a transition hub between China and the EU. This deal has the potential to reduce the trade imbalance, the trade deficit, which is to the detriment of Turkey. Turkey also wants to reap the benefits, reap some cutting-edge technologies by collaborating with China. And on the other hand, for China, it is also important because the products produced here will be exempt from tariffs. due to the fact that Turkey has customs union with the European Union.
The planned factory is a way to avoid the EU's new tariffs on Chinese vehicles. But the new investment is also seen as a sign of a shift in Beijing's policy towards Ankara. While Turkey is part of China's global investment strategy through its Belt Road Initiative, or BRI, and Beijing has voiced interest in Turkey becoming a trade route from China to Europe through its Middle Corridor Initiative, such collaboration have until now been just empty words, says Ceren Ergenç, a China specialist at the Center for European Policy Studies.
After bilateral meetings of, say, foreign ministers, they of course emphasize Turkey's involvement in the BRI and China's interest in Turkey's middle corridor and whatnot. But when you look at the practice, you don't see these investments in Turkey. And the reason for that is China perceives Turkey as a high political risk country in the region.
But that is changing. And some of the Uyghur community are worried that Turkey may be turning on them. Ankara has been critical of Beijing's crackdown on its predominantly Muslim Uyghur minority and has offered refuge to many. Uyghurs have for years used Turkey as a base to campaign against Beijing. But Uyghur dissident leaders fear China's billion-dollar investment in Turkey could be part of a deal struck during Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan's recent visit to China. Çağdaş Unger of Istanbul's Marmara University.
There are rumors, of course, that the Chinese side is pressing for the ratification of this extradition agreement, that they would want the Uyghurs in Turkey, some of them at least, to be returned to China, to be tried in China, etc. If we see in the coming months that kind of, for instance, ratification, or if we see Turkish side being more willing to return those people back to China, dissidents or the terrorists, I mean, depending on how you see it, we will see that there was something groundbreaking about this.
But China's pivot towards Turkey, a NATO member, could be part of Beijing's increasing competition for global influence, especially with the United States. Unger of Istanbul's Marmara University says Ankara and Beijing are finding increasing diplomatic common ground, including criticism of Israel's war on Hamas.
If you take, for instance, the Gaza issue right now, Turkey and China, even without trying, they see eye to eye on this issue. Their foreign policies overlap and it becomes very much different from most of the other Western countries. So there are certain issues at a global level, at a regional level, that China seems to be a much better partner than the Western countries.
Ankara welcomed Beijing's hosting of Palestinian leaders last month. Israel's war is threatening to escalate, and that can only provide more common ground between Ankara and Beijing. Doreen Jones, DW, Istanbul.
DW.
Finally this week, after saying adieu to the Olympics, Paris is welcoming more than 4,000 athletes for the Paralympic Games that start next week. Many spectators with disabilities will also attend those events, putting the spotlight on just how accessible the French capital is to people with special needs. Olympic authorities have praised Paris for its strides, but disability advocates say it's only a start. Lisa Bryant reports.
Frank Mai is taking a visitor through a slice of his day, getting from his home outside Paris to the eastern part of the city. He drives his electric wheelchair to a local station, which is handicap accessible. But catching a suburban train, known here as the RER, isn't easy. Mai speaks with a ticket agent to alert train staff of his arrival. He enters through a special door reserved for wheelchairs, but also for people with bikes and baby strollers. Down an elevator and onto the platform, where an agent rolls out a ramp for him to board the train. Finally, he's on his way.
Quand on parle d'accessibilité, on parle de l'autonomie.
Accessibility means complete autonomy to go from point A to point B. Today, when people say Paris is handicapped accessible, that's not the case.
Mai has a degenerative condition called Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease. He's a former Paralympic athlete, winning 4 bronze medals in swimming in the 1988 Summer Games. His battle today is access.
Ce qui manque aujourd'hui, c'est la concertation.
What's missing today is consultation. We're always informed that something has been built after the fact. We need to be asked before every renovation, for example, of the metro system, about accessibility. People need to think differently.
French authorities have worked to make the 2024 Summer Games accessible to everyone. There are shuttles and taxis specially equipped for wheelchair users. Buses, trams, and some street crossings are designed for people with mobility, hearing, or vision impairments. Paris City Hall says the changes are part of a bigger effort to make Paris greener and more livable.
On est très accessible aujourd'hui, vraiment. On a fait d'énormes progrès.
Paris is very accessible today. We've made enormous progress. There are still things to improve, but we've seen a radical change on the ground.
Lamia El Araj is deputy mayor in charge of access and matters dealing with people with disabilities.
Hosting the Games offered us the opportunity to redevelop the city to make it more accessible.
El Araj says those transformations include creating pedestrian-only areas and fully handicap-accessible buses. The city has widened sidewalks and plans to have 95% of municipal sports, educational, and other public buildings handicap-accessible by next year. But handicap advocates say mindsets also need changing.
We still need to develop in France this capability of delivering service to everybody.
That's Serge Vidalski, Director General of advocacy group APF France Handicap.
When we show the laws that we have in France, like for instance in Brussels, among our peers in other countries, they say, oh my God, you have incredible laws in France that we don't have anywhere else. The only issue is that they're not applied.
Frank Mai gets off at the Châtelet station in central Paris and boards Line 14. It's the only line of the Centriole metro system, which is not managed by the city, that is fully accessible. Mai and other disability advocates say their fight isn't just about changing transportation, but also other basics of daily life that pose challenges for the elderly, people with crutches, and many others.
On ne considère pas les personnes en situation de handicap.
Pascal Ribe, president of APF France Handicap, also uses a wheelchair. She says people don't consider people with disabilities as citizens in their own right. Society has not thought about integrating people with disabilities so they have access to everything, she says, like everybody else. Yes. Mai finally reaches his destination, the Gare de Lyon train station. It takes another elevator and down a few halls before he's out and heading into the city. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
And Inside Europe airs on radio stations around the world and is picking up new listeners on podcast platforms. The more the better, so please remember to hit the subscribe button and give us a review as it helps promote our show to other listeners. This program was produced by Helen Sini and sound engineer Mikhail Springer. And I'm Nick Martin. Thanks for listening. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Germany.